Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the tense situation on the Ukraine-Russia border, where Russia is conducting military exercises as clashes are underway in Crimea between supporters of the new government in Kiev and Russian nationalists who seized government buildings and hoisted the Russian flag. David Speedy, the director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs, joins us to discuss how a conflagration might be contained and a return to a Cold War-like confrontation avoided. Then we'll look into the extent to which the U.S. has been taken to the cleaners by Russia and Syria's Assad regime with a chemical weapons deal that has only yielded 4% of Assad's arsenal and keeps him in power while he tortures the relatives of rebel negotiators at the Geneva peace talks brokered by the U.S. and Russia. A specialist on Syria, James Gelvin, professor of history at UCLA and author of The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know, joins us to discuss secret negotiations underway in Switzerland between the US, Iran, and Syria. Then finally, we'll examine the new labeling on packaged food announced at the White House that would make calorie counts more prominent, focusing on calories over fat. The president of Eat Drink Politics, Michelle Simon, a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics that harm the public's health, joins us to discuss this first makeover of food labels in 20 years that targets added sugars. And joining us now is David Speedy, the director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs and previously a senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Speedy.
Thank you, Ian.
And clearly with Russian military exercises going on near the borders of Ukraine and with pro-Russian activists, armed activists, taking over government buildings in Crimea, putting up the Russian flag over the Ukrainian flag. You have pretty much a tinderbox, do you not, in Ukraine? And how much do you think Putin is bluffing?
Well, you know, obviously, yes, you're correct. There is a tinderbox situation, but this is not new. This has been going on for a couple of weeks, and just as there have been, just as there are pro-Russian forces in Simferopol taking over regional government buildings and hoisting the Russian flag, so there were also armed, masked Kalashnikov-wielding militants taking over government buildings in Kiev. And I'm afraid what this really means is that the fault lines between East and West and Ukraine, between Kiev and South, namely Crimea, the fault lines that divide Ukraine ethnically, linguistically, culturally, really are playing out along these series of armed interventions and highly volatile and dangerous events. I don't think bluffing is really how I would, upon due reflection, characterize what Putin is doing. I think Putin is obviously gravely concerned about events in Ukraine. He does not need this in any sense of the world, instability in Ukraine. He's got his own problems, of course, within the Russian Federation in the south, in the Caucasus territories, the North Caucasus, and southern Russia. Of course, he's very much engaged in the negotiations in Syria and so on. So, you know, Russia has its own basket of problems and I don't think he wants Ukraine to be added to that.
But after all, though, it was Vladimir Putin who basically has made this a zero-sum situation where...
No, I don't agree with that. I'm sorry. I really don't agree. But carry on. Please.
Well, I was going to say, by basically telling the Ukrainians it's either, us or the EU and it has to be us, the Ukrainians don't have the ability, apparently, to have a system of governance of their own that maybe borrows from both the EU and Russia or is a hybrid of some kind. Isn't Putin the one that's more or less making it a stark choice between him and the EU and making it clear that he's the choice?
No, I agree entirely with one half of what you say, Ian, and that is that the future for Ukraine, if there is to be a stable, peaceful, and prosperous, corruption-free Ukraine, it must be, I don't know if hybrid is exactly the right word, but it's certainly points in the right direction of something that's neither beholden to Moscow or to Brussels or Washington or whatever. It simply must be a Ukraine for Ukrainians and the best governance for that country and not one that's in the pocket of either. I would only say two things. First of all, I think both sides have done their part in creating the zero-sum game. The EU came in with a very clumsy overture toward Ukraine with, of course, a financial inducement that was regarded as inadequate by the Ukrainians. And then, it, of course, if you remember, it put certain conditions such as the release of Mrs. Tymoshenko from prison, which, of course, has happened. But that was seen widely in Ukraine, and not just by Yanukovych, as interfering in Ukraine's internal affairs. So I think, unfortunately, there has been a case of both sides contributing to this idea that Ukraine must be either for us or for them, or with us or not with them. And the other thing is that look, I'm sorry, I think one has to recognize that there is a legitimate concern for Russia in terms of, first of all, Ukraine is its neighbor. I think if we had grave instability in Mexico or Canada, not that it's going to happen, but we would be concerned. There's a historical close bond between Russia and Ukraine. There is a Black Sea Fleet, which is based, of course, as you know, in Crimea, and has a legitimate negotiated contract to be there until 2042. So I think that all of these are seen as, and there have been attacks, sort of symbolic efforts to proscribe or outlaw the Russian language. There have been threats to Russian Orthodox churches. I'm not saying any of these things would allow it to happen, but there's been enough that at least in a symbolic way, I think, Putin has cause for concern.
Well, apparently Secretary of State John Kerry has proposed cooperation in phone calls with his counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. But Kerry also did make that remark about Rocky IV.
which An unfortunate reference, I think. But
yeah. What is it, exactly was that remark? Because I missed that one.
Well, it was a little ambiguous. Rocky IV was apparently, if I remember my pop culture, which I do not, but I believe that Rocky IV was sort of the heroic little pugilist immortalized by Sylvester Stallone from Philadelphia, taking on a hulking Russian approximately twice his size. And Kerry ostensibly was saying, we're not in a Rocky IV situation. In other words, this don't sort of make that association. The problem is, of course, it evoked images of the Russian bear, of the overbearing, sort of bullying, and so on and so forth. It was not exactly a diplomatic high note for the Secretary of State, in my opinion.
And it did, of course, that film was made during the Cold War. So all of that baggage is brought into that comment, right?
Unfortunately, a lot of baggage from the Cold War persists, and that is an insignificant but telling image that perpetuates that.
Again, I'm speaking with David Speedy, who's the director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, and previously was a senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Now, apparently in the west of Ukraine, after World War II, there was a very bitter battle between separatists and the Red Army. And so you have histories of guerrilla activity in Ukraine, which would make me think that Putin really would not want to send the military in there. I think that would be a catastrophe. But let's talk about the various regions of Ukraine, because clearly we hear about the division between the east and the west, but there are divisions between the north and the south as well. So just walk us through that, if you will, David.
Well, when I visited Ukraine, I really can't say I was in Ukraine. I was in Kiev. And at that time, I was told that basically there were four Ukraines that we had to take on board. The east, which, of course, is heavily Russian-speaking, pro-Russian. If you look at the results from the last election, it's almost like in this country, the red-blue divide with the eastern part of the country having very, very heavy majorities in favor of Yanukovych, and then in the west, equally heavy majorities for the opposition. And then there is Kiev itself, and of course Crimea, which is kind of sui generis. And with all sorts of complicating factors like ethnic Tatars who were persecuted under Stalin, repatriated to Ukraine after the end of the Soviet Union, and so on and so forth. So it really is quite a sort of polyglot and pastiche of different ethnicities, history, culture. If I may just say one thing about your comment about the end of World War II, Ian, of course, one thing, memories are long, and there is there have been quotes from certain forces in the south in Crimea of Western Ukrainians being pro-Nazi in World War II, and you know, the country being divided along those fault lines. It, of course, World War II ended 70 years ago, but still, as I say, memories are long. So all of these things conspire to create this this really severe internal schism within what ought to be a sovereign country.
Well, my memory of history of World War II in the Soviet Union and Ukraine, it may be a bit cloudy, but I recall that Hitler had, because he was such a racist, had contempts for the Slavs, which is, of course, the heart of being Ukraine, and that had he not been such a racist, he may well have ended up being able to co-opt the Ukrainians to fight with him against the Soviet Union. Is that?
No, I think that's right, but I think that there were ethnic Ukrainians who were collaborators, is my recollection of history.
Right.
You know, the fact of the matter is, it was a sort of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, I suppose, at work. The enemy being the Soviet Union, of course. And the way it plays out in the contemporary situation is that I have been told by people who know the situation in Lvov that there is some sort of ugly anti-Semitic manifestations, houses being daubed with slogans like "Jews live here." So it's unfortunately a situation like this, which you accurately describe as a tinderbox, unleashes a sort of mixed metaphors, a nest of vipers that take on some very ugly manifestations, and this unfortunately is one of them.
And I believe in the south, as you mentioned, the displaced and repatriated Tatars, apparently there are clashes between Tatars and Cossacks going on.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. And as I say, you know, the term fault line comes into play, and there are so many fault lines in a place like Ukraine. It's obviously a strategically highly important country in terms of location. It's a country that logically belongs to and ought to be part of Europe. I mean, if one were able to sort of wave a magic wand, then both Ukraine and Russia would be part of a harmonious Europe. Both have great European traditions. Russia, of course, is a Eurasian country, but it again is such a pity that the various forces that have come to conspire to create this current situation have created the zero-sum situation of Ukraine as either looking east or looking west.
But isn't Putin basically laying down that Eurasian marker? I mean, he's trying to form that union with Belarus and Kazakhstan.
Sure.
And his appeal is that we're different. We're not like those Europeans who coddle homosexuals, etc.
Well, you know, I did various interviews on Sochi and the LGBT situation. I mean, I completely agree. Please bear in mind that in this country, at least 14 states still have anti-gay laws on the books. It's only been 10 years in a mature democracy that the Supreme Court struck down what we call anti-sodomy laws.
Sure. And by the way, everybody's celebrating what happened in Arizona, but similar laws to discriminate against LGBT people are active in, I believe, Kansas and Oklahoma. I'm not sure of the list of states.
Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma, North Carolina, and so on. And there have been prosecutions even since the Supreme Court decision. Anyway, I didn't mean to get sidetracked into that, but you know, the fact of the matter is that Putin is trying to create the Eurasian Economic Union. And the question one would ask, without getting into the whole 22-year history of the post-Cold War period, is what else is he supposed to do? I mean, Russia has gone through a series of things that it regards, from the point of view in Moscow and beyond, as humiliations: the expansion of NATO to its borders, a war against its ally in the former Yugoslavia, in Serbia, various rebuffs over things like missile defense and so on. So all of these are sort of, you know, large sort of geostrategic issues. But the fact of the matter is that Russia now feels that it has to look beyond the U.S. and the West and create its own sort of sphere of concern, if not sphere of influence. And I've also written a piece that basically posits the idea that if 22 years ago the Cold War had ended, the Warsaw Pact had been triumphant, and the United States completely defeated, Mexico, Canada, and the European countries were all invited into the Warsaw Pact, how would we respond? I don't think we'd roll over and play dead. I think we'd try to revive our interests in ways that might not play according to the agenda of the superior powers. So it plays a little. I think it really does have a certain relevance to what has happened in the all too brief, but nevertheless, traumatic 22 years since the end of the Cold War.
But David Speedy, Ukraine joining NATO is not on the table.
No.
But obviously, if Ukraine integrates its economy with Europe, it is a huge blow to Russia, who depends upon that market.
It is. And again, I'm not an economist, but one also sort of, it raises the sort of innocent, almost king has no clothes question. Why is Ukraine so anxious to join the EU at this point? I mean, the EU has its own issues, shall we say. The Eurozone in particular has some very serious issues. Ukraine joining the EU at this point, joining an alliance like EU or NATO comes with strings attached and performance issues. And obviously, one would imagine that Ukraine would be a member of a club that would have the same sort of performance at this point, or performance levels as some of the countries like Greece, Portugal, Spain, to some extent Italy perhaps, that have their very severe issues within the EU. So, I'm not saying that for Ukraine we should look upon EU as a sort of poison chalice, but I think it's something that ought to be entered into with sobriety and clear eyes.
Well, it's a country on the brink of bankruptcy, isn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, in other words, for all of the problems with Greece and the bailouts, et cetera, and this north-south divide that is where Germany's basically saying, you know, we pay our taxes and we're not going to subsidize these lazy people in the south who don't pay taxes and have ghost jobs, et cetera. I mean, if the Germans complained about the Greeks, they're taking on an awful lot with Ukraine.
I completely agree.
So what do you think is going to happen? This is obviously a tense moment. Presumably, cooler heads will prevail. But what's your long-term prognosis here?
Well, you know, my friend here in New York, Steve Cohen at NYU, has written in The Nation that he fears that the Putin bashing that's going on and the general situation in Ukraine, we could be heading for a new Cold War. I stop a little bit short of that. I think there have been other grave moments, such as the Serbian. I was actually in Moscow at the time when the bombing of Serbia was going on, and I can tell you that was a very, very tense and ugly moment to be a Westerner in Moscow. I think that I hope cooler heads prevail. I think that we managed to come together with, I have to say, a certain amount of initiative on the part of the Russians, of Lavrov and Putin on Syria, which certainly in terms of human tragedy is a much graver situation. And so I just hope that, going back to, I think, something you said at the beginning, that the West and Russia really has to sit down in a spirit of guiding Ukraine to a future that is best for Ukraine, of working out the political, economic, and other monumental challenges that exist, and at least coming together in a sort of interim governance situation that buys time, that provides a cooling down period for elections to take place later in the year, where one hopes credible candidates with a commitment to economic reform and political inclusiveness come to the fore.
Well, David Speedy, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian, very much.
Again, I've been speaking with David Speedy, who's the director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, and previously was a senior fellow at the Belfast Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the extent to which the U.S. has been taken to the cleaners by Russia and Syria's Assad regime. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the part of the present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you, Ian.
And I'm beginning to wonder here, we were just talking about U.S.-Russian cooperation over Ukraine and what issues they're working on, which might restrain both parties from getting into a new Cold War. But as far as working together on Syria, it does look as though the Russians and the Assad government in Syria have taken the U.S. to the cleaners. We've been had. I think John Kerry's more or less suggested that as much. I think about 4% of the chemical weapons have only 4% have been turned in.
Right. Assad has asked for another 100 days. The inspectors don't think that's necessary. Of course, he will remain in power so long as the inspections go on and the removal takes place. He's absolutely necessary to pinpoint where these things are, and he knows this full well. The Russians know this full well as well. So there's plenty of reason for him to stall on the chemical weapon.
And apparently, in terms of these unproductive talks in Geneva between the Assad government and the Syrian opposition, now the State Department is complaining that the Assad government are retaliating against Syrian opposition representatives to the Geneva peace talks by arresting their family members.
Well, the talks themselves were always a long shot for the United States. That being said, of course, the United States has no other options at the present time. American policy is focused on the idea that we can't let Syria turn into another Libya. We can't let Syria have a hard fall. There has to be a soft landing for Syria. And in order to ensure that that takes place, there's got to be some sort of negotiated settlement. Now, that is very likely not going to take place, but it's the only way in which the American policy can actually be implemented. And it does put us at a certain amount of mercy of the Syrian regime on the one hand and the Russians on the other hand. What we have to do is we have to make sure that the Syrian regime continues to negotiate, that it has to work in good faith, that the Russians put pressure on it, on the regime itself. So, therefore, the United States doesn't have very many cards that it can play at the present time. Now, the difference between Obama and McCain is that Obama probably realizes that the United States has been had, but can't really do anything about it. And McCain realizes that the United States has been had and wants the United States to do some futile gesture that would try to shift things around. It's not going to work.
In other words, you know, send over a few cruise missiles and rattle the rubble.
Something like that. But, I mean, the problem, of course, is that nobody except a very, very slight grouping within the Senate is in favor of something like that. If you look at the American population, more Americans think that Congress is doing a good job than want to intervene in any way in Syria. So it's a very, very unpopular thing. Obama realizes this. McCain probably realizes this as well, which allows him to strike a heroic pose in spite of the fact that it would have no effect anyway.
Well, meanwhile, on the rebel side, it looks worse and worse. This group, ISIS, who are antediluvian, it looks as though, they're now in the area of northern city of Raqqa that they control. They're now levying attacks against Christians that goes back to the Dima in the Quran, where they're insisting on half an ounce of pure gold in exchange for the safety of the Christians.
I think we can read what's going on in terms of ISIS in multiple ways. I mean, you're absolutely right. These guys are barbaric, but they're so barbaric that what's gone on is they've turned much of the Syrian population against them. What you have now is you have Islamic fighters, members of the Syrian Islamic Front, who are fighting not only against ISIS, as well as against the regime. But you also have, for example, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the official affiliate of al-Qaeda in Syria. And al-Qaeda now is so unpopular in Syria that what Jabhat al-Nusra has had to do is to get rid of much of the ideological trappings of al-Qaeda. So they say now that they're fighting to overthrow the Assad regime. They say that their interests are only Syria. Al-Qaeda's interests, of course, al-Qaeda doesn't believe in nation states, doesn't believe in Syria. So in order to be able to maintain their popular base, Jabhat al-Nusra has to get rid of the ideology that is the only thing that binds al-Qaeda together. In the same way, what they've done is they've promised areas that they've liberated that they're not going to act in the way that ISIS has acted as well. So what we see now going on is splits within al-Qaeda-type factions. What we see is large parts of the opposition fighting against al-Qaeda, the Syrian Islamic Front, the Free Syrian Army, the various Kurdish factions as well. So there are people who say that this has demonstrated that al-Qaeda is on the rebound, that the Syrian uprising has been very good for al-Qaeda. I think it's just demonstrated just the opposite.
Again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. But al-Nusra also just suffered a pretty devastating defeat on the battlefield. A lot of their fighters were ambushed by Assad's forces. There have been reports for some time now indicating that Assad basically leaves the really extreme people alone, like ISIS, and either goes after the Free Syrian Army or the moderate groups. So where would al-Nusra fit into that?
Well, al-Nusra is trying to situate itself between the so-called more moderate factions, including the Syrian Islamic Front and the Free Syrian Army on the one hand, and ISIS on the other hand. So what they've tried to do is set themselves up as leading negotiations amongst the factions. We should not lose sight of the fact, however, that Jabhat al-Nusra is al-Qaeda. They've been officially recognized by Zawahiri as being the official franchise of al-Qaeda in Syria. And so, therefore, these people, you know, we can't look at them as being moderate in any way. They have just shifted a bit in terms of what their ideology is. But we would be no better off if they won than if ISIS won.
So the agony is just going to continue? Is that the prognosis? I saw an extraordinary picture of as far as the eye could see, just a sea of people crowded into this devastated, narrow street, heading out apparently in a moment where there was an amnesty. They were just getting out of the war zone. These are people that have been caught in the crossfire. It was truly a disturbing image.
Yes, it's very likely going to continue without a break at this point. The government feels that it has the upper hand, so the government is going to continue using the sort of weaponry that we've seen in Aleppo, for example, barrel bombs and what have you, in a terror campaign. What they will not be able to do is to remove the opposition from much of the countryside. So what we're going to see is the government are going to retake the cities, the most important areas in the west of Syria, but very likely what's not going to happen is that they're going to be able to take back large chunks of the rural areas and the far east as well. So at best what will happen is we settle into some sort of stalemate. Now, while we're focused on that, we should also understand that the Geneva option is not foreclosed, not entirely foreclosed at the present time. What the United States undoubtedly is doing is working around the edges of Geneva and of these various things. There's been all sorts of, for example, rumors that the United States has been meeting with Iran and with the Assad government in Bern, the capital of Switzerland, for example. And this would make sense. As anybody who is a member of any sort of corporation or academia or any organization like that knows full well that real decisions don't get made in front of the, in these huge meetings in which everybody's represented, that the real decisions get made on the periphery. They get made in offices and hallways and places like that. And what the United States very likely is trying to reach for at the present time is some sort of understanding with the two most important operatives in the opposition, which is Russia and Iran. And very likely what they're trying to do is to get more and more issues on the table so that there could be more and more trade-offs that could be made with both Iran and Russia. Iran wants the sanctions lifted. Iran wants some sort of understanding around this nuclear program. Iran wants its sphere of influence in the Gulf. These are things that the United States and Iran can sit down and begin to negotiate in terms of a broader issue, bringing in Syria at the same time. And I think this is a diplomatic strategy that has the most likelihood of actually working.
But the Iranians and the Russians and the Assads have always had their eye on the ball. They've known exactly what they want. They haven't bent one inch. So far, they seem to be winning. What's the incentive for Iran to lean on Syria to make any kind of concessions?
The Gulf, Afghanistan, Iraq, the end of sanctions, a nuclear deal. There's all sorts of things that Iran really wants that are far more important to Syria. You had mentioned earlier about, you know, the Russians and Ukraine, for example. There's all sorts of ways around on the periphery of Russia, in the Caucasus and areas like that, that the Russians consider to be far more important to them than Syria. So understandings can be reached by the United States, by Russia, by Iran, by various other groupings as well within the region. It will not be reached by Saudi Arabia. It will not be reached by other major players on the American side that, you know, feel that Iran is an existential threat. But that's not America's problem at the present time.
But the picture that you painted earlier, James Galvin, of a Syria in which Assad controls most of the coast and Damascus, and then that the rest of the countryside is pretty much controlled by the rebels, is that the future of that country? Could it be viable, partitioned in that way?
No. But we're not talking viability here. What we're talking about is perhaps another Somalia. There are many places in on Earth at the present time in which you really do not have effective government over much of the territory of the sovereign state. And so it's very possible that Syria will go down that road as well, which, of course, is an incredible tragedy.
And one that, you know, when we were saying earlier, there doesn't seem to be any real way. Now going back to that, the possibility of a U.S. military action, of course, John Kerry undermined any credibility by talking about an incredibly small strike. But is there, to your mind, a point at which the United States will reach a point where they just so feel that they've been had so much that they feel like, you know, screw this, let's teach this guy a lesson?
I'm not sure. I don't think it's likely, but of course it is possible. The Kerry remarks, I think, were ill-advised, but they should be interpreted in a very, very specific way, which is that the United States was not going to launch strikes to topple the Assad regime. The United States was going to launch strikes in order to degrade the Assad regime's capabilities. And that would what the United States wanted to do was to tilt the battlefield in a more even direction so that the Assad's forces would not be able to maintain at this point the momentum that it now has. If that occurs, if they see themselves as hopelessly deadlocked, that's the only situation in which they would sit down and negotiate in good faith. If both the opposition and Assad's government, on the one hand, view the situation as hopelessly stalemated on the battlefield, and as well the United States, the Iranians, and the Russians come to some sort of understanding on wider array of issues at the same time, then very possibly there could be a negotiated settlement. But the United States is really betwixt and between here. You know, on the one hand, the fall of Assad, as it presently would be constituted, is not particularly something that the United States would want. The various al-Qaeda forces have been able to take over areas of Syria in the same way that they've been able to take over areas of Yemen and other failed states as well. So this is something that the United States is very, very hesitant about on the one hand. So there's really nothing else it can do but to try to ensure that the soft landing that I had mentioned earlier is reached by, you know, all parties involved.
Well, James Galvin, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the first makeover of food labels in 20 years. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michelle Simon, a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics that harm the public's health. She is the author of Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back, and is the president of Eat Drink Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Simon.
Thanks for having me.
At the White House today, Michelle Obama was joined by Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius and the Food and Drug Administration's Commissioner Margaret Hamburg to announce the release of a proposed rule for revising nutritional labels on food packages. She's saying that our guiding principle here is very simple, that you as a parent and a consumer should be able to walk into your local grocery store, pick up an item off the shelf, and be able to tell whether it's good for your family. Do you think these reforms or this new labeling will achieve that?
Well, certainly an improvement. There's no question about that. I mean, you know, most of the information on the nutrition facts label goes right by people because it's just all a blur. But, you know, if you look at the new version that's being proposed by FDA, the biggest number you see is calories. It's really huge. So I think that's certainly an improvement to let people know right off the bat how many calories they're getting. And the other important change, well, two more important changes. One is serving size. You know, most of the serving sizes on packages are just too small to be realistic for what most people are eating. So we're going to see some changes there. And then the third important change is the requirement for a line for added sugars, because some products like dairy that contain dairy or fruit may have some natural sugars, but what we really need people to be aware of is how much added sugar goes into these processed foods. So, you know, this isn't obviously earth-shattering. It's going to change people into eating, you know, a whole lot healthier overnight. But for those consumers who are aware of this type of information, it will certainly help them.
Well, of course, in terms of added sugar, high fructose corn syrup is ubiquitous, isn't it? I mean, just about everything in the supermarket has it in it.
Yes, that's true. I mean, because it's one of the cheapest forms of sweetener, high fructose corn syrup has become largely a sweetener of choice, particularly for soft drinks. But all forms of sugar, and there are many of them, are shown to be detrimental to the diet.
So was there some good news lately about the reduction in childhood obesity? I noticed there was a study that just was released a few days ago.
Yes, there was some data out of the CDC saying that in very young children between the ages of 2 and 5, there was a significant reduction. I think the number was 46% reduction over maybe a 10-year period. And, you know, that certainly is good news. The bad news is that all the other age groups have remained steady. We haven't seen any reductions. But for me, you know, obesity isn't really the best measure of health. It's simply a weight measure. What we really need to be looking at is actual health measures and, you know, not just weight. So, you know, it's certainly a positive sign, but we have a long way to go for people to be living healthier lives in this country.
Well, we certainly have a long way to go, apparently, in terms of taxing soft drinks as we tax cigarettes and alcohol. The links have been made to how much sugar is in soft drinks and how much soft drinks, Coca-Cola, et cetera, are consumed, particularly by recipients of food stamps and poor people who tend to use sugar as a way to stretch, to dull the appetites and stretch their food budget, which is very limited. Where do we stand in terms of any movement in that direction? Because other countries have done it. Right next door, Mexico just recently adopted a similar tax on sugary beverages.
Yes, so there's certainly many public health advocates in this country that want to see soda taxes as a way to help curb consumption of sugary drinks. And there is some evidence to suggest that that could be helpful. I'm not sure that's necessarily the best way to go, but it's certainly worth a shot. And right now we actually have a pretty good shot with a measure in San Francisco to do exactly that, to tax sugary soft drinks in that city. And, you know, it's going to be a big fight. I mean, it's already started with the soda industry forming its front group and going door-to-door to retailers, getting them to sign up on their opposition list and basically lying to them about what it's all about. So, you know, this is going to be a big fight, you know, way right into the fall and for when voters get to decide on that tax proposal in San Francisco.
So, Michelle Simon, again, a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics that harm the public's health. She is the author of Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back, and is the president of Eat Drink Politics. And I've spoken to a number of researchers in childhood obesity and who are studying the effects of sugar, particularly in sugar being metabolized through the liver. Dr. Lustig at UCSF, a leading specialist in that regard, he's written books about it. It seems to me that, to put it bluntly, sugar is a toxin. And so what's being done in terms of educating the public about that blunt reality?
Mm-hmm. Well, public health research has shown that education is really the best way to go. I mean, there certainly have been some efforts in San Francisco also to do some public media campaigning around this problem. But really what public health research shows is that by changing the environment that people live in, by reducing the amount of sugar, other sugar isn't the only problem in the diet, but basically changing the environment so that healthier foods are more available, more affordable, then you automatically shift people's behavior because that just becomes the norm. Right now we have a situation where people have more access to the least healthy food and they're the cheapest. So we need to flip that around. And there are many different efforts going on to do that. I mean, even the new labeling requirement for having added sugars could motivate the food industry to reformulate because they might be embarrassed to say how many grams of sugar are in their products. And that's what we found when trans fat was required. So it's these kinds of policy changes that really help motivate industry and change the environment and the options that people have available to kind of nudge them into healthier choices.
But so often, candy and sugar, of course, being the main ingredient, are used as a reward for children. If a parent were to recognize that they're poisoning their child as opposed to rewarding their child, wouldn't that make a difference?
Well, certainly. I mean, look, parents are often, a big part of the problem because they were raised in a certain way and they're simply not educated. So, I'm not saying education doesn't have a role to play. I'm just saying that, we need a multifaceted approach to fix this very, challenging and vexing problem. And I worry sometimes that, the industry loves to focus on education, right? We don't want to see any real policy change, just educate people. But again, that's not what worked in reducing smoking rates. Certainly helping people stop was part of it, but it was real policy reform, higher tax rates on tobacco and smoke-free laws. It was laws that changed, that got us to a place where we can, claim some victory over smoking, obviously not completely, but it's really changing the environment through public health laws that help reduce these types of harmful behaviors.
Well, but the turning point wasn't that when all those CEOs of tobacco companies tried to, with a straight face, say that smoking doesn't have any ill effects, health effects, right? Wasn't that... I think it was Waxman's committee that got
that. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that was a turning point. I would say that was part of, a concerted effort to expose the tobacco industry's, dirty tactics and lying about their products. And there was a series of events that unfolded. And that was definitely one of the more dramatic ones where those CEOs got up in front of Congress and lied, saying that their products weren't addictive. But, there were release of documents. There were many things that really happened to help demonize the industry. And that's what makes for a political environment that allows higher taxes and other kinds of legal reforms to, again, create that better environment that we need for people to not engage in these destructive health behaviors.
But is that to say, Michelle Simon, that the food and beverage industry is also hiding data?
Well, we don't know. That's certainly a big question a lot of us have, is if we were to, engage in perhaps more aggressive litigation. There are some cases being filed against the food industry for deceptive marketing. Who knows? There could be a treasure trove of documents somewhere hidden. Probably most of those documents have already been shredded because they saw what happened when the tobacco industry got in trouble for the disclosure of secret documents there. But, some people are hoping there's still some documents being squirreled away to show the deliberate manipulation of food ingredients to get people hooked. And, we certainly have some evidence of it, and it's just common sense. Obviously, food companies manipulate the ingredients of their products to get people to eat more. That's how they sell more product. But, to the extent of their knowledge of it, the extent that they, are deliberately engaging in these tactics is something that we would need some more evidence of, and I think could be almost, I don't think we're ever going to get to the place of, the real smoking guns that we got with tobacco. But I think we could get some more information for how companies manipulate the ingredients of their products to ensure that people keep eating more, because that is the name of the game for them.
And Michelle Simon, just back to the news today of the first change in food labeling and packaging, the first overhaul in 20 years that with new emphasis on calories and sugar. In recent years, some countries, Australia, Britain, Sweden and Denmark, have adopted an at-a-glance labels on packages that give consumers a sense of the overall healthiness of the food, using such things as star ratings, traffic light colors, or numerical scales. How does this new approach announced today meet up to those other standards used around the world?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, FDA isn't proposing anything like that. You know, we're not seeing, traffic lights or anything that, I mean, they're just really sort of moving the black and white letters around and making for larger font sizes and making the information that's there more clear. But you're right. I mean, other countries certainly have a little bit more of a bold approach and more clear messaging for consumers. But, I mean, you know, the politics here are just so difficult. It was a miracle that FDA could get this kind of a proposal out the door.
So is the problem or the people that are resisting the Grocery Manufacturers Association?
Well, of course, it's the grocery, you know, manufacturers and their lobbying group, as you mentioned, is the GMA. I mean, you know, what's going to be interesting is to see exactly how the companies fight this. I mean, they're saying all the right things so far because they don't want to look bad with the First Lady being out on front with this. They know how popular she is. But we have a long way to go with the comment period, and then industry will even have a two-year phase-in period after the regulations are final. So, you know, there's still a fight ahead in terms of what comes out at the other end of this process.
But in terms of improvements, because I'm always looking for good news, Michelle Simon, and frankly, on a daily basis, I don't tend to report very much. Mm-hmm. It seems, though, that at least with this new labeling, you don't have to do a lot of math to understand how many calories you're about to consume.
Absolutely. Look, I'm, you know, the first one to criticize the federal government when it comes to our food policy, but I am actually pleasantly surprised with this proposal. I think FDA is definitely being bold here with, you know, the improvements. I mean, looking just side-by-side comparison of the current label with the new proposed label, you can really see the difference. And I think that they deserve credit for, you know, being willing to go out on a limb. And, of course, having the First Lady at their side doesn't hurt, given her popularity. So I think this is a good day for at least a very narrow slice of food policy in America.
But we know how Washington works, and isn't it very likely now that that there'll be a lot of lobbying on Congress and they'll be weighing in and they're slowing things down? One of the tactics they use nowadays to slow down any reform is to say, oh, it needs more study.
Right. Well, you wanted good news, so I was giving you the good spin.
Right, but I want to be realistic here. You know,
you're absolutely right. Like I said, this is a process. But, you know, one of the good signs was if the White House doesn't want something to happen, they know exactly how to bury it. And the main way they do that with regulations is by holding things up in the Office of Management and Budget, through which all government agency regulations must be approved. And there are numerous FDA regulations even being held up in that OMB. In contrast, these nutrition facts label regulations were pushed through in something like 2 or 3 months, in time for the 4th anniversary of Let's Move that is happening this week. So that tells you when the White House wants to get something done, they get it done. And that's what happened here. So, you know, I think that's hopefully will carry through. I mean, obviously, they only have a few years left, and this could be dragged out. There's no question about it. And, you know, the food industry is very good at going to their friends in Congress and flexing their muscle there. But, you know, this is in the White House's hands because this is a regulatory process. So, you know, I'm hopeful that these labels will come out, you know, not as perfect as we would like, but certainly improved from where they are now. But I think the important thing to remember is this is still a very small aspect of our overall, you know, food policy agenda and food systems. You know, nutrition labeling, look, let's be honest, most people shouldn't be eating food that comes in a box for very much of their diet anyway. So this is really, you know, rather uncontroversial in the larger scheme of things, but it's still a move, a good step forward.
Well, maybe we should have Michelle Obama weigh in more often. Are you suggesting she's more effective than her husband?
Well, she's definitely more popular. I mean, you know, we have the data to show that. She's definitely more, you know, I mean, but that's also because she's up till now been staying out of the controversial areas that he obviously can't stay out of as, you know, the leader of our nation. So it's been I think, a really interesting dance that the First Lady has been playing in her leadership role on childhood obesity. I mean, up to now, she's mostly stayed out of the policy arena, with the exception of school food. She's formed partnerships with private corporations, you know, the likes of Disney and Walmart, and I've been very critical of that. And this is the first time we're really seeing her step fully into this policy arena, but again, by, you know, making this announcement side by side with FDA today, and then earlier this week with the USDA on some school food improvements and marketing to children even in schools, a very controversial issue. So, you know, there's definitely a shift going on where I think, you know, some say she's responding to criticism that Let's Move has been too cozy with corporations, and now she's, you know, taking a stronger stand in some, on some policy issues. And, you know, I have to say, I think that's mostly a good thing, and I think the results, you know, yet to be seen. But it's certainly an interesting move for her.
And Let's Move, her project, of course, is also involved with not just nutrition, but with exercise.
Right. Well, that's, you know, one thing I've been critical of, because we know that what children need, may certainly need to exercise more, but the most important thing is the children need healthier diets and access to healthier food, and they mostly need the industry to stop exploiting them with incessant marketing. And unfortunately, that is one area that the First Lady has not been able to do much about, mostly, again, because she's not the leader of the country in terms of public policy. And she's not really been able to get the food companies to stop marketing junk food to children. Her tack on that issue instead has been to get some companies to promise to, you know, market healthier foods. For example, she partnered up with Subway a month or so ago, saying they're going to, you know, market to children to pile on the veggies, you know, which I'm not that impressed with. I don't think kids should be eating at Subway at all. So, you know, again, this is the sort of happier approach, but you know, to get companies like McDonald's and General Mills and all the other junk food companies to stop targeting children with the real harmful messages, that has not been on the First Lady's agenda, or I guess I should say she's not had any success, either through private dealings or through public policy. And that is, to me, the most important issue facing children regarding our, you know, in the food arena, is the marketing to them, and not just in the schools, but in general. So, you know, but that's a tough nut to crack, and that's one that she's, you know, tried, but I can understand why it would be difficult. So I think it's important to see, you know, where she's able to push, like on a nutrition label, which is not that controversial, although the food industry is certainly going to fight back there. But, you know, she's not going to have as much traction on an issue that is much more, you know, important to the food industry, like marketing to children.
Well, Michelle Simon, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Michelle Simon, who's a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics that harm the public's health. She is the author of Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back, and is the president of Eat, Drink, Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.